From the Sky News Centre at 5. Police have admitted they were alerted to an alarm going off at a central London jewellery raid on Good Friday, but didn't respond. The call was given a grade that meant no police response was deemed to be required. Former detective Barry Phillips believes it will be impossible, though, for people to keep quiet.
They will. They'll be going into the pub, they'll be bragging to friends, and somebody somewhere will be lured when it's eventually offered by what will be a substantial reward. To come forward, and again, no honour amongst thieves, or just through sheer jealousy.
Ed Miliband's made a plea to the Scottish voters today. Simon English reports.
I'm delighted to introduce the leader of the Labour Party and next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Ed Miliband.
Speaking in Edinburgh alongside his Scottish deputy Jim Murphy, Mr Miliband claimed that if the SNP were handed control of Scotland's finances, there'd be a £7.6 billion black hole. He's asked leader Nicola Sturgeon.
Which services will be cut? Which taxes will be raised?
She's denying the claims.
The only cuts on the horizon for Scotland are the cuts that the Tories are proposing and Labour has signed up to.
Elsewhere today, the Conservatives are promising to freeze train fares, while cheap loans for first-time renters are being promised by the Lib Dems.
The pound's hit its lowest level against the dollar for 5 years. It's believed to be caused by uncertainty about who'll win the general election. One of the youngest children to plead guilty to murder has been jailed for a minimum of 11 years. The 13-year-old boy pleaded guilty to stabbing Christopher Barry in North London last December. Cricketing figures are paying tribute to Richie Beno, who's died aged 84. After captaining Australia, he went on to become perhaps the game's greatest ever commentator. And Sue Perkins has denied she's going to be the next presenter of Top Gear. The Great British Bake Off star is now the bookies' favourite to take over from Jeremy Clarkson. However, she's taken to Twitter to deny the rumours. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
Do you think we're living in a healthy democracy? Are you happy with your elected representatives in Bristol, Westminster and Brussels? If so, don't listen to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, 5 to 7, every Friday, with me, Tony Gosling. Friday Drive Time, 5 till 7 on BCFM, 93.2. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock and welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Bradley Stoke, UKIP councillor Ben Walker. I'm afraid there's an empty chair where we've invited the Conservative Party to come along, but they've declined. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, homeless Bristolians and their supporters are coming together tomorrow for a march and rally through the city centre calling for an end to evictions and more council spending on emergency accommodation. And more importantly, I'm joined by Ben Ritchie from the squatting group Bristol Housing Action. Sunday's Malcolm X Film Festival takes place this weekend. These are the films and talks a million miles away from the mind-numbing garbage on offer at the mainstream cinemas. And talks too by anti-racism activists and filmmakers too. I'm joined by one of the organisers of the day, Sukant Chandan. And secret courts. Ironic that in the year of the Magna Carta anniversary, trial by jury is being dispensed with. And remember the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6? Would these miscarriages of justice be exposed today? Secret courts have begun to try the most controversial cases in the country where many believe the authorities are fitting up terror suspects. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, clear but mild, around 8 Celsius. This weekend, mostly sunny, but warmer on Sunday. That will be up to and above 16 degrees Celsius. Next week, more sun, particularly midweek, up to 20 Celsius, but cooling to 10 and rainy by Friday. Next weekend, the 18th and 19th of April, more rain possible, but should clear up by a sunny Sunday next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Bradley Stoke, UKIP councillor Ben Walker. Hi Ben, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Do you want to give us a potted history of how you defected from the Conservative Party to UKIP up in Bradley Stoke?
I did. I defected some 3 years ago now. And I, at the time, I was a district councillor on South Gloucestershire. Obviously, I've moved on since then, and I am now the UKIP parliamentary candidate as well for Filton and Bradley Stoke in May.
Why though? Why the change? Why did you decide the Conservatives? Because I mean, you know, local people elected you as a Conservative, and you, in a way, what you're doing is you're sticking two fingers up at them and saying, "Well, actually, I've had enough of the Conservatives. I'm going to go and join UKIP."
I guess you could look at that. I think I've said to you before. I mean, I did hold quite a large personal vote, but obviously, people did vote for me as a Conservative. There was a few reasons. I won't go into all of them now, but one of the main ones for me was I'm a huge advocate of the NHS, and we were made to go out and canvass, in fact, for the last general election, and say to people on the doorstep, there will be no top-down reforms of the NHS. And I'm sorry, you can kind of see what they've done from space now. So it was really disingenuous and really quite dishonest. And that was just one of many reasons why I decided to turn my back on them.
Well, it's a great pity we haven't got the Conservative councillors in here. I mean, an empty chair sitting over there, because earlier in the week I contacted some of the main people on the cabinet, the leader of the Conservative group on the council, and yesterday spoke to the Conservative office, say nobody's put themselves forward, can you find anybody? And so of all their councillors, they couldn't find anybody today. I just wonder if you've experienced that yourself, and that you know, whether you think that there may actually be a policy that the Conservatives don't want to go head to head with UKIP. I mean, you can imagine Nigel Farage and David Cameron on national television, for example. I don't think Dave would like it.
No, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't, and I'm pretty sure as well that there's got to be some sort of central party line at the moment where candidates for all seats, you know, council and parliamentary seats, are they're stepping back and not wanting to come forward and take on people in debates. Whether it's UKIP or not, I don't know. I think there's a strong chance that it is, but even in some of the hustings we've had and some that we've got planned, we're not even sure that our, you know, our incumbent, if you like, our MP for the last 5 years is going to show up anyway. So there's definitely something going on.
How have you found the election campaign so far?
Really busy, flat out. For me and in my area, we are, and I'll be quite honest about this, we are seeing a huge groundswell, and I would go as far to say that I think it's going to be an extremely tight race in Filton and Bradley Stoke, and if we can just get the wind behind us, there is every chance.
You've got several councillors on Bradley Stoke Town Council, haven't you?
We do, yeah, and obviously we're playing for more on all the parish and towns and also the district, so the, you know, the sister of Bristol sort of thing.
Now, why is it that you support UKIP so much? UKIP is seen in two main things. One is anti-EU.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, there's a trick, isn't there? They always talk about it. Tony Blair was doing it this week. We mustn't leave Europe. Well, actually, sorry, Tony, but you can't move the map. It's not Europe you're talking about. It's the EU you're talking about.
That's right.
But they always say Europe, don't they? Yeah. To sort of confuse you. So what is it? What's your big beef with the EU?
Well, but it's the political union. That's the major thing for me. I mean, it's not so much that we... I mean, well, if we go back, I think you could ask any UKIP member and they wouldn't be against being in a common market or have a common market trading agreement with countries that have like-for-like economies. I don't think anyone can say that's a bad thing.
Well, that's what we voted for back in the 70s,
isn't
it?
But now that's not what we have. We have a political union and you have other countries like, for instance, Romania, who are now members and have open access to this country, and they're national minimum wage is 9 times below ours. It's not equal.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is bringing you on this because the goalposts have shifted since the vote to join the European Union, European Economic Community back in the 70s. So the goalposts have shifted, the Europe's got bigger, also the power of Brussels has got a lot greater. With now we've got European Parliament MEPs who are making legislation which is effectively Brussels telling us what to do.
Well, I mean, we all know what the debate about this is. Some people are not very happy about these developments.
Are you in favour of a referendum for because there's a new Europe, isn't it?
Not really, because I think if people want a referendum, there are candidates who are going to push for a referendum like our friend here. We've made our position clear that it's not the priority. My priority, personally, is that the banking system is still insolvent, and that is probably going to... Say Greece leaves the EU, it may do in the next week or so. If it does, that will crash the banking system, which will put everybody on the dole across the world. That's the reality, and arguing about whether we are in or out of the EU in the face of that is rather secondary.
Ben, what do you make of that, Martin's point there, that actually what you're doing is just distracting from the main issue, which is how are we going to deal with the banks?
Well, I mean, as ever, I find it very hard to say to mine. I don't agree with you. I generally do on loads of things. But he's quite right. And obviously, Greece are in a really difficult position at the moment. And I don't disagree with anything he said. But the main problem is that Greece are also being kept in the position that they are due to Germany and the EU and its constraints. And that's quite unhelpful too. So I don't know, we could kind of go around in circles on this one, I guess.
Well, I think what will happen is if Greece does leave and it causes a major crisis, then everybody will have to raise their game in discussing what they're going to do about it.
I think you're right, yeah.
Okay, so the other big story this week, Ben, with the UK Independence Party, is that one of your local candidates has been discovered to be a porn star. Did you know about that before this was in the Bristol Post the other day?
I personally didn't know, although I have met him on a couple of occasions, and he's a thoroughly, very nice gentleman. I didn't know, but then what I would say is that, you know, we are a different branch as well, and almost we do operate like a separate area. So our interactions with that branch is not, you know, it's not huge. But no, didn't know.
But is it going to win you votes, do you think? Because there's the argument that what people do within the privacy of their own home or in their own private business is neither here nor there.
It's the personal feeling and perception about it, isn't it? I mean, you know, he has not done anything illegal. There is, you know, it's quite legal and straightforward what he has done. I don't even know if he's still doing it. I know he's done it in his past, I'm not sure. But so there's no issues on that front. I guess, will it affect us? There's the possibility that people that were sat on the fence might think twice. That is true. But what's also true is that you need people from all sorts of walks of life to get in. And actually, I would happily have more people from every section of society that are playing their part and trying to stand up and represent people. So I guess that's a good thing. My only question would be, they maybe could have foreseen this and maybe thought a little bit differently about it.
He's the vice chair of the Bristol branch of the party. I mean, and he's been leading a secret double life. Are there any other skeletons in the UKIP closet?
Well, not in mine. I don't know about theirs.
How do you know?
Well, what, in mine? Well, yeah. I'm pretty sure.
In your own personal closet, I mean, maybe.
No. My closet's pretty clear now, and I've just had a clear out and bought some new shirts as well. So, yeah, no, I'm
but
okay.
But Bradley Stoke, I mean, this is always bound to be a problem, isn't it, with small new parties. But what about the key thing here, Ben, which is that effectively UKIP is becoming a protest vote. There's a two or three main policies to do with immigration and the EU, but the rest of it, you're making it up as you go along.
I don't know if we're making it up as we go along. I mean, we do have, there's a leaflet which we've been circulating for a long time now, which is called Policies for People, and that's based on another one, which is What We Stand For. So there's core beliefs that the party has, and most of our ideas are always based around our core beliefs. Although our manifesto has been delayed, but it is due out, I'm told, next week. So, you know, we will get more, I guess, sort of polished up.
Will you
up
get any surprises
policy
in there? Things you, as you look through that manifesto, think, oh God, do I have to support that?
Possibly. I mean, I think it's, you know, every party is always the same. You're never going to agree with everything that they believe or they want to do.
Martin, what about the possibility that when people vote for Ben or other UKIP candidates, actually what they end up doing is voting, if a UKIP MP gets in, that they just do a deal with the Conservatives after the election?
Well, it's not unlikely. I don't think that's the real problem. I think the real problem for those on the right is that UKIP is likely, I mean, for example, were you successful in Filton and Bradley Stoke, you'd remove a fairly right-wing Tory MP. What would be more worrying for us is if you were making inroads in our heartlands, because that would then make problems for us. But on balance, I think the assessment in the Labour Party is that whatever damage UKIP does to us, it's going to do a lot more damage to the Tories. And I think the electoral system is at fault here. This is the real problem.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, this is why you know, normal politics broke down in Northern Ireland in 1969, is because the electoral system did not allow sufficient flexibility for everybody to pursue their goals in an open manner. And if you've seen what's happened in Northern Ireland, the Loyalist parties have already done a deal before the election, and I'm quite sure something similar will happen on the Nationalist side. Now, what we've got similar problems in Scotland with the SNP and Labour. We're competing for the same people, just as UK we're competing for the same votes as the Conservatives. And I think if we do get a very perverse result where UKIP do well but don't get many seats, it's going to raise more questions again about whether the electoral system needs to be reformed than I think it does.
Ben, you know, you're talking about the principle of the NHS being the reason, main reason why you decided to migrate from the Conservatives to UKIP. But of course, Nigel Farage was caught on film, wasn't he, calling for a move away from State Health Service.
I think this whole, and there's also been, you know,
what he said. Okay, let me just quote that the state-funded NHS should move away to an insurance-based system.
I think what he's trying to say there is when that comes to new people that come into the country, so we're looking for some sort of health insurance cover, so there's not an immediate draw out of the welfare system for people who haven't paid in.
Martin.
Well, I think the problem with this is that health is, you know, when somebody's ill, you either treat them or you don't. Mm. And I think that it's very interesting. If we did have a reform of the electoral system, I think that UKIP itself would find that it was split between more right-wing on economy and more left-wing on economy people. And in fact, that doesn't matter too much in a PR system because everybody can find their niche. The problem with our current system, it forces people into alliances because that's the way it works.
Look, it's September 2012, he said it, and Farage saying that he believes the marketplace could deliver better value for money when it comes to spending on the NHS.
Well, I think that's just wrong, and that just... I mean, he's a former stockbroker, privately educated stockbroker. There are other people in UKIP who are ex-lorry drivers and what have you. I think the fact is that you can't actually ultimately fudge these things. But I think if we were changing the electoral system, then all of these things would come out in the wash. What we've got is a bit of... the system, frankly, is not fit for purpose, given the scale of the economic crisis.
The Scottish fish offensive, I call it that, because, of course, we've got sturgeon and salmon. Martin, the electoral landscape is going to change a lot in Scotland. The SNP are going to get a lot of MPs. There'll probably be 90% of... Pinch the 90% of what are currently Labour MPs in Scotland. And how's that going to change things after the election? Because it's going to mean that the SNP are going to be a very strong position to form a coalition, possibly with quite a large Liberal Democrat wipeout.
Well, it's not that I don't think there'll be any formal coalition. I think both Labour and the SNP have ruled that out
because it'll, of the Trident.
Yeah, well, but for various reasons. But I think that one of the problems you see because of the geographical concentration of the SNP's support, the first past the post system helps to boost their outcome. Meanwhile, because UKIP's got its support scattered around the country, it's likely that they will get more votes than the SNP, but they won't get as many seats. Now, that's been true for years for minor parties like the Liberal Democrats and so on. But I think this is a very interesting election because it isn't just a straight Labour-Tory fight, but the electoral system makes it a bit of a roller coaster ride. And I think the only people who really understand the thickets of this are the Northern Irish politicians who've been dealing with the consequences of it for years and years and really know it all inside out.
Now we're going to take a bit of an excursion away from the normal mainstream style debates here, because I've been getting rather irritated this week to hear the BBC's Making It Clear jingles like this one.
Election 2015, Making It Clear.
Clear as mud, as far as I'm concerned, because there's no proper discussion about economics at all, particularly to do with the fundamentals of the money system and whether that's ever going to change, and also whether we're sitting on a cliff as regards to the potential of a financial crash, as Martin mentions week after week. Martin, this week we've got, yesterday in fact, both on the same day, two bits of news. One is that the balance of payments or balance of trade deficit is at the 30-year high, and yet the stock market is at an all-time high too. So how can we be importing so much more than we're exporting, and yet our companies apparently are doing better than ever?
Well, the stock market is completely divorced from reality. What quantitative easing has done, not just in Britain but also...
Is this really since QE started?
Since QE started, and we now got a bigger debt bubble than we had before 2008, and it's the big 13th fairy at this election, which nobody's really wanting to discuss. Everybody's talking about what kind of recovery we've got, how we can make it work for ordinary people or not, and so on. And we still haven't really faced the realities that the financial system is severely broken. It was broken in 2008, and it's still not been fixed. Andy, what's his name? He was the guy who did the Commons Select Committee report on this. He's a
Andrew Tyree
did quite a good report, I thought, pointing out what the problems were. But then it was
he was saying basically you've got to get retail banking and completely put an air gap between it and the casino banking merchant banks.
Indeed he did, and it was an all party committee, and I thought he did a reasonable job. But it was immediately kicked into touch.
But it was just ignored, wasn't it?
Yeah, because the real problem is the political power of the big banks is enormous, both here and in the US, and no government, even a left wing Labour government, or like Syriza, for example, they can't fight these people because they're too powerful with their political power. And it's because once they've been bailed out, they're stinking rich anyway, and you've bailed them out, that puts them in a very strong position to dictate to everybody, and that's exactly what they're doing.
What are your thoughts about the macroeconomic side of things? Because, I mean, this has a big impact, particularly on things like employment, Ben.
It's huge, and I mean, it's quite... I guess we're fortunate in a way, because all of our debt problems as a nation aren't dissimilar to Greece. We're really quite like them. You know, we've got massive, you know, trillions that we owe. How we're ever going to pay it back?
The national debt's now around about 1.5 trillion.
We won't be paying that. I mean, as Keynes pointed out in the 30s, debts that can't be paid won't be paid. Yeah. It's just a logical point. And the market solution for this is a crash. But the problem with that is that the social implications of that are unthinkable.
Yeah, well, it's always the people at the bottom that suffer the most, isn't it? Always. And we've seen that in the last, in the term of this government, to be quite honest.
Well, what bothers me is the austerity for the many has meant actually a cash bonanza for the few.
Well, that's right. There is no crisis for the people at the top. The very wealthy have done very well out of the crisis.
There's something really quite perverse about it. But anyway, one of the things that really helped me understand the money system was watching a film called The Money Masters back in 1996. This was made by a chap called Bill Still in the United States. And he goes right the way back to the time of Christ, to the temple and the money changers, and Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple. But why did he do that, and what were the money changers in the temple actually up to?
Just who are these money changers James Madison spoke of? In the Bible, 2,000 years ago, Jesus drove the money changers from the temple.
It was the only time Jesus used force during his ministry. What were money changers doing in the temple? When Jews came to Jerusalem to pay their temple tax, they could only pay it with a special coin, the half shekel of the sanctuary. This was a half ounce of pure silver about this size. It was the only coin around at that time which was pure silver and of assured weight without the image of a pagan emperor. Therefore, to Jews, the half shekel was the only coin acceptable to God. But these coins were not plentiful. The money changers had cornered the market on them. Then they raised the price, just like any other commodity, to whatever the market would bear. In other words, money changers were making exorbitant profits because they held a virtual monopoly on money. The Jews had to pay whatever they demanded. To Jesus, this totally violated the sanctity of God's house.
Well, an interesting take on it, Martin, because, I mean, there is a virtual monopoly now, or an oligopoly, on the creation of money by the private banks 2,000 years on.
Well, yes, and I think if you're coming back to the biblical example, don't forget that the Romans wanted their taxes to be paid in their money, which they created, and it reminds me of what the British did in Rhodesia in the 19th century, where basically people were living perfectly happily and said, you've got to pay our taxes to us in cash, which means that you've got to work on our farms to earn the cash to pay the taxes. So the money is used as a means of control, as we all know.
But surely it's the government that awards and the Treasury that awards banking licenses. If they don't behave, the banks surely can have their licenses taken away.
I think if we go back to the 80s and the monetarist revolution, as it were, in Britain and in the US, it became increasingly apparent that the government doesn't control the money supply. The government produces coins and cash, but that's a tiny fraction of the money supply. Most money supply is created through the creation of private bank accounts and the creation of bank accounts by the private banks.
And then that money is then lent. Yeah,
well, there's increasing debate about this across the political spectrum, with both left and right wing people saying that the banking system should be or the central banking system should be nationalised.
Well, it's one thing,
and that's actually the right in America are calling for the abolition of the Federal Reserve and so on. And this is quite interesting that there's this convergence going on. Actually,
I wonder. I mean, you're probably not the sort of thing you get asked on the doorsteps, but your thoughts, Ben, about the idea of having a money system which actually serves the public, because it seems increasingly that we're slaves to the money system and slaves to money. You know, we haven't got the resources we desperately need, and there's not enough to go around.
Well, I don't disagree with that. And I mean, for many things, you know, when it comes to it could be railways and it could be health, my personal beliefs, and not necessarily of my party, are that those things should be state-owned. You know, they are there to serve the public. So I would be all for a bank of England that you know, sought to look after its residents.
Well, never mind taking a monopoly on the money like the money changers did in the temple 2,000 years ago. There was another big step in the money system, and that was the fractional reserve banking system. Before we hear this clip from the Money Masters about that, Martin, fractional reserve, what is it?
Well, basically, as we all know, if everybody turned up at a bank and asked for their money all at once, the bank would go bust because they haven't got it all. So fractional reserve banking...
So where has that actual extra money come from that the bank has lent out?
When the banks lend money out, they make it up and lend it out. Yeah, that's what they do.
So they're sort of just waving a magic wand, yeah?
Yeah, they're creating money to lend it out. And, of course, they lend out an awful lot more than they've actually got. And that doesn't matter as long as everybody doesn't turn up and ask for it at once. And fractional reserve banking is the idea that a certain proportion of their reserve, you know, they've got to keep at least 10%, say, so that if everybody turns up at once, they've at least got 10% of the money. But of course, the fraction has now become so ludicrously small. I mean, it used to actually matter quite a lot, fractional reserve banking, you know, in the 50s, for example. You know, if it was 10% or 5%, make a big difference. Now it makes hardly any difference because the actual amount of money they've got to keep in terms of the actual huge, it's becoming more and more minuscule. And in fact, more radical free market types are saying we don't need any fractional reserves at all because it's so small it's hardly worth bothering with. Well, but in other words, it's actually a house of cards.
Back in 1996, Bill Steele and the Money Masters put it like this. This is how he explains fractional reserve.
1,000 years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser.
Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking, that is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception.
So there you go. That's the crux of how the banks over the... Oh, that was actually only 1,000 years ago, not 2,000 years ago, started to circulate far more of these notes, Martin, noticing that people didn't all come in to collect their money at the same time. But then the problem with that is, what if they do all come in at the same time? All of a sudden, you're going to get yourself some sort of a banking crash. Now, gold... used to mean something. In fact, it actually says, doesn't it, on a pound note, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £1. But actually, if you take that to the Bank of England, they're not going to give you anything for it. It's just a piece of paper.
Well, the Bretton Woods system that was set up after the war in 1946, with big influence from Britain, with Keynes being involved in it, it was a gold-based system ultimately. The US dollar became the world's reserve currency, but the US dollar, in theory, could be exchanged for gold. And that means you get the best of both worlds, in theory, because you've got it's backed up by gold, so they can't just inflate it, but it's also paper money, and therefore you can expand it or you can reduce it according to circumstances. Because the real problem with a gold-based system, that's just a gold-based system, is that there's only a certain amount of gold around, and you can't actually flexibly vary the money supply. But the problem is, in 1971, they couldn't afford to carry on fighting the Vietnam War and keep the dollar on gold. So they took the dollar off gold in order to fight the Vietnam War, which they could do because they were in a strong position. And at that point, of course, you then started to get all of the problems that we've now got, which is that the, you know, they've been printing money ever since, effectively, and a massive, massive bubble has now grown over the years in US dollars.
Okay, it's not
which is probably going to crash.
It's not the easiest question, but I'm going to ask both of you: how do we deal with this? It's like, you know, we're in a kind of bind, aren't we? In hock, quite literally, to a handful of international bankers.
Well, I think the real problem is that they can't control the outcomes. And if ultimately...
Are we just going to have to wait for a crash?
The market will work in the end. The dollar is gradually being undermined. I mean, a lot of the wars the US are fighting are for example, they attacked Libya quite probably because they were going to bring in a Libyan gold dinar, which would then have been a standard across Africa.
A threat to the IMF.
Based on gold, which would have undermined the American position. That's right, yeah.
Okay, so how do we deal with it? Come on.
Well, I think the fact is that people all over the world are starting to deal with it. They see the Chinese have just set up an alternative investment bank to the World Bank, and Britain, amongst others, and lots of others, have all rushed forward to join
it.
But
what should they be doing at the Treasury right now? I mean, doing something like the Greeks are thinking about, going back to the drachma and actually starting again from scratch?
I think the problem is that we're too far gone. When the crash happened in 2008, that was the time to start reforming the system, and we've basically done nothing for 8 years.
Isn't it forgiveness of the debt or writing off the debt?
I mean, one of the things, you either have a crash or you have an orderly write down of the debt. You look at what the amount that Greece supposedly owes. It's fantastic, actually. It's not real what they owe. It's based on interest payments you didn't meet.
Compound interest.
So on. You say, well, you can't possibly pay that. We'll have to wipe a lot of that out. And that means that some people then have to, you know, some wealthy people have to lose their money. But it's done in an orderly fashion. But if you don't do it in an orderly fashion, it will happen in a disorderly fashion. And that's probably what's going to happen.
Hey, what are your thoughts about all this, Ben?
Well, I think it was Gordon Brown that said, wasn't it? I was going to end the boom and bust. And I think Martin's quite right. I don't think our system allows nothing but the boom and the bust. And I think in 2008, when the credit crunch happened, I think Martin's right. I think we should have done much, much more. I think that was the perfect opportunity to zero the books and start again and make the reforms that we needed to sort of, you know, press ahead in a moral and intellectual fashion, I guess. Nothing's happened, and I guess the only way to really to do it is to literally zero debt, start again, but start again properly.
That's what a crash will do.
Yeah.
But of course, the consequences of a crash socially are devastating.
They hurt, yeah.
So the likely outcome of that is kind of war and conflict.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, once a country's gone down the drain like Ukraine has done, then you're not in a position to do anything much.
Now, yeah. Argentina had it, Russia had it, a very fast collapse of their currency. Is that the sort of thing we'd expect?
Yeah, and you'll see a ricochet effect, you know, and contagion spreading very, very quickly. In the 1930s, after the stock market crash in the US, it took quite a while, months to years, for that to work its way through into a depression. But what will happen now is the computer screens will all go red simultaneously. It'll happen in an afternoon. And there's no way of protecting yourself from it.
Well, interesting. Anyway, this is the sort of stuff you're not going to get on the BBC.
This is not being discussed in the mainstream.
Making it clear. This is the
real problem, and nobody wants to talk about it. And it's not just because the politicians... Two things about this. Politicians don't understand it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, people don't want to hear it. And politicians are there to get elected, and they don't get elected by telling them things they don't want to hear.
People don't want bad news.
I wonder what else is there not being discussing as part of the election campaign.
It's part of the delusionary world we're all living in.
But anyway, as part of a sort of a parting shot from Theresa May, if we can call it that, I'm not sure if we're allowed to, on terrorism, her talk a couple of weeks ago on extremism. The idea is apparently there's going to be no more tolerance of intolerant views. I'm not quite sure how she works that out. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Theresa May's short pronouncement on what's happening with extremism. And I want you to think, as you listen to this, how do you define an extreme view?
Extremism can take many forms. It can be ideological, or it can be driven by social and cultural norms that are contrary to British values and quite simply unacceptable. We've been clear all along that the government's counter-extremism strategy must seek to defeat extremism in all its forms. But it's obvious from the evidence that the most serious and widespread form of extremism we need to confront is Islamist extremism. Islamist extremists believe in a clash of civilizations. they promote a fundamental incompatibility between Islamic and Western values, an inevitable divide between them and us. We will deny extremists the opportunity to spread their messages of hate by introducing banning orders for extremist groups that fall short of existing terrorist prescription thresholds. We will introduce extremism disruption orders, civil powers to be used against individual extremists who incite hatred. The game is up. We will no longer tolerate your behaviour. We will expose your hateful beliefs for what they are. Where you seek to spread hate, we will disrupt you. Where you break the law, we will prosecute you. Where you seek to divide us, we will stand united, and together we will defeat you. Thank you.
That's the Home Secretary Theresa May there speaking about extremism. Martin, she's saying if you seek to divide us, but I think for a lot of people, society is already divided in all sorts of different ways.
Well, I think a lot of this is I'm going to exercise my freedom of speech here. A lot of Islamic extremism has its roots in British policies in the 1980s, when we armed and trained a group which eventually morphed into Al-Qaeda to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. Operation Cyclone had Britain as the lead agency in the Western powers, which is why a lot of Islamic extremists ended up living in London, because they were there as guests of MI6. And if I give you a little example, Abdul Hakim Belhaj, who is now the leader of ISIS in Libya, has an intimate relationship with MI6 going back 30 years. He was involved in the attempt to assassinate Gaddafi, I believe, which MI6 cooked up in the 1990s. And so this is all very, very, to my mind, the fact is, in Syria, we've seen the British government encouraging people to rebel against the government and supporting and arming and training very definitely Islamist terrorist groups. And then, of course, they say, oh, well, we've got to intervene now to stop these Islamist terrorist groups, which we have, in fact, armed, trained and created. I think a lot of the so-called Islamist extremist groups are, in fact, penetrated completely by Western intelligence services and are at their behest. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. The Russian General Staff agree with me, and they're the people we're really going to have to fight.
Ben, Theresa May's talking about banning people who incite hatred, but I mean, how do we define this? And also, I mean, she also immediately going on to Islam and Islamist, whereas, I mean, if you look at Zionism and Zionists, they're actually, it's an apartheid state in Israel and an apartheid situation. So is that not some form of hatred, apartheid? Anyway, what are your thoughts about this whole idea of the counter-extremism strategy, the prevent strategy, and the idea of criminalising certain ways of talking and thinking?
Well, it's an interesting kind of speech by Theresa May, because, to be honest, it's all very well, you know, giving it the big one, I guess, now, in you know, coming up to an election and stuff. But the fact of the matter is that she is repeatedly ripped money away from the security services and police in this country, yet expects all this of them. And I find that very difficult to try and understand. Yet, you know, she wants all these things to happen, yet doesn't fund it properly. And when it comes to the extremist kind of views, I mean, I do not for one minute support anything that ISIS have done. But like Martin, I have serious concerns, and you have to ask yourself, why are we in this position with them anyway? I mean, Britain's foreign policy has been absolutely dreadful for over 100 years. I mean, the way that we kind of view ourselves in the world and the way that we enact that, it's dreadful.
We don't see ourselves as others see us.
I think you're right, yeah.
We very much live in a bubble.
Yep. And we, you know, and actually the funny thing about that is we're critical of the Americans for doing that.
Yeah.
But we better look in the mirror, I guess.
Okay, so where do you draw the line then between inciting hatred and stopping freedom of speech?
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, I have some views on certain things, and people may not, you know, may not like those. But, you know, we fought really hard to have a freedom of speech, and I think that should be protected.
Isn't there a sort of basic principle around here that you can say what you want, it's only when you actually take action to do something criminal that's criminal? What Theresa May is saying here is actually just by talking about something.
Well, the fact is, we've already got perfectly good laws against violent behaviour. and those who engage in violent behaviour can expect to be punished. But the fact is that political opinions are going to be polarised. And I think this bogey person of Islamic extremism, we really need to get to the bottom of this, because the Britain in particular, with the US, have been we are supporting Saudi Arabia today to bomb in Yemen, where they've got no basis to be. There's no basis.
Well,
international
breaking
law.
International law.
It's breaking international law.
Isn't that an extremist view? Michael Fallon, maybe?
Well, you could argue that therefore the British government are supporting Islamist extremism of the Wahhabi variety in Yemen, and therefore they should all be prosecuted.
This is the bizarre thing about that particular conflict. Is that the Saudis and the Brits actually seem to be supporting Al-Qaeda?
Well, indeed. Well, as we have been in Syria, and everybody in Syria knows it. And at the same time, I think there's been manipulation going on all along here. We've been creating our enemies, and then those involved have been saying we need more resources to deal with them. So, in a sense, I'm contradicting what you're saying. Mm. The intelligence services and the military have their own vested interests in having enemies to fight and so on. And of course, there's other interests at work. What's underlying what's going on in Syria is two alternative views of what oil pipelines should run through it, oil and gas pipelines. One from Iran to the coast, which is supported by the current regime, or one from Saudi Arabia to Turkey, which is supported by the rebels. And that actually is the bottom line of what's going on. And all the stuff about Islamism and all the rest of it is a secondary phenomenon.
I would actually like Theresa May to explain to me what Western values are as well, because I'm a little bit unsure of what they are. And, you know, to compare them to the Islamic values or... explain, please.
Well, one of our values is that people are allowed to say what they like.
Isn't it? Right? Yeah, that's what I thought.
During the war in Ireland, at one stage, of course, the provisionals were not allowed, or the Sinn Féin were not allowed to go on television and all the rest of it. But it wasn't very successful. Mm. It didn't work. And ultimately, of course, it was not a viable strategy.
No.
If people have got that point of view, then they've got it. And you're not going to stop them expressing it if they want to express it.
Surely it's up to the opposing force, I guess, or party or whatever it is, to actually set their case out.
Exactly.
Anyway, we haven't got the Conservatives. Just to remind you, listeners, we did invite Conservative councillors on this evening to have our pre-election discussion here, but they couldn't find anybody to come on, even though I spoke to them a few days ago and spoke to the Conservative office yesterday lunchtime to say, please, will you send somebody? But that doesn't mean to say we're not going to have any Conservative voices, because we're going to hear now from the Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, and he was having, if you want, a broadside from one of his battleships against... Ed Miliband, saying that he can't be trusted with national security.
This general election is about, in the end, just one word: security. Our economic security, our nation's security. Come the 8th of May, in just 4 weeks' time, it will be either David Cameron or Ed Miliband who crosses the threshold of number 10 and takes responsibility for our nation's future. Every day it becomes clearer that Ed Miliband will do anything to get into Downing Street. Day after day, he refuses to rule out categorically doing any deal with the Scottish National Party. That silence speaks volumes about the man, his weakness, and his refusal to be straight with the British public. Above all, his willingness to play fast and loose with one of the most precious things that any Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is entrusted to protect, the security of our country. Today I want to talk about the long-term threat to Britain's security that would be posed by a Labour government propped up by the SNP. Imagine Ed Miliband limping into office, aided by the crutch of the SNP. On Tuesday night, Nicola Sturgeon was explicit. In a statement that was as arrogant as it was terrifying, she said she was, and I quote, offering to make Ed Miliband Prime Minister. And she has made crystal clear the price she would demand: more spending, more debt, unlimited welfare, and scrapping our nuclear deterrent.
Now, Ben Walker, UKIP councillor in Bradley Stoke, you're ex-Navy. Surely you've got some views on Trident and the nuclear deterrent.
Yeah, I do. I guess I'm probably a little bit one-sided, though, to be honest. I mean, yeah, I'm ex-Navy. I didn't serve on submarines. I was general service, but I do support the Trident program, not only just as a nuclear deterrent per se, but more as an employment program as well.
Sure, there's cheaper ways to give people jobs.
I'm sure there is, but you know, I am an advocate of the Trident program. I think it's probably the one thing that we should probably have as a military deterrent.
Any thoughts about whether we need four of these submarines or three of these submarines?
Obviously, it's currently four. I think there is a strong case to maybe have three. And in my experience, you would normally always have two operational subs and then one in a refit or a DD, well, whatever it is.
What's the point of having these submarines if the US has a veto on whether they're used or not? Because it's not really an independent nuclear deterrent, is it? Because of this, the technology involved, basically the Americans decide they don't want us to use them. We can't.
This is all to do with our special relationship, isn't it, I guess?
So what's the point of having an independent nuclear deterrent if it's actually not independent?
Yeah, that, you know what, I don't have an answer for.
Martin?
Well, I think that says it all, doesn't it? I mean, it's not independent. I can't see, even from a military point of view, that it makes sense to starve the army of boots and stuff when they're supposedly, you know, doing sterling work in Afghanistan, which again we could question whether they should be, but nevertheless that seems to be what we're doing. It's an unusable, you know, there's no credible circumstances.
What about the wider point
that the
Defence Secretary Michael Fallon's making there? Actually, Ed Miliband can't be trusted with this important job. He's just.
Well, I think from my point of view,
no experience.
I've protested against nuclear weapons all my life.
Nuclear weapons. But we're talking about national security generally.
Well,
he's got no experience.
Well, I mean, I think Nigel Farage made some very interesting comments about what went on in Ukraine and in Syria. And I think that the Tories are actually playing this national defence card without looking at what, you know, they're actually looking for trouble. The French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas has been on French television over 2 years ago now, and he said when he was Foreign Minister, he was at a party in Britain, he was approached by British officials before the Arab Spring, and they said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria, would you like to participate?" Now, so we've got prima facie evidence that MI6 were involved in starting the war in Syria. And the former British ambassador to Damascus wrote in The Guardian this week saying that Cameron nearly dragged us into war in Syria. Mm. Thank goodness that he didn't. And that's hardly been mentioned in the election campaign. I think Ed Miliband did a reasonable job there of putting the kibosh on it, and then the American Congress picked up where he'd started. I think if we're talking about security, the real danger is belligerent warmongering without thought of the consequences.
Well, we've seen the effect of that. I mean, I actually served on HMS Southampton in the Afghanistan War, obviously not on the ground, but we were supporting the air campaign there. And I never wanted to be there, and I think all of my shipmates couldn't really understand what we were doing there and what our job really was.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, there is this kind of something we've come across on this show with Chris Mulligan, whose dad was a CIA officer. Did an interview with him a few weeks ago where he was saying Vietnam was a lose scenario. It does seem to me that there's more and more of this going on where the armed forces go into a conflict knowing they're going to lose.
That I don't know. I mean, whether the top brass know, maybe. I mean, certainly the boots on the ground, no way. They won't know a thing. They're just doing it for Queen and Country or whatever. You know, that's their job, that's what they're going to do. But Martin's alluded to it, and there is huge truth in the fact that, you know, all the security services and the governments play their part in pulling the strings and starting these conflicts.
There's a lot of pressure, I imagine, also. Absolutely. From the arms industry. You know, the people who are actually making weapons, selling weapons to the government, actually have got to keep those conflicts going. Also, of course, with the banks in the background lending to both sides often in conflicts. You know, you've got a quite nasty little situation there, and it's a shame that in the leadership debate we had last week there was really very little talk about foreign policy.
Miliband's position on Trident,
immigration.
Miliband's position on Trident is very disappointing to me, and disappointing to many people on the left of the Labour Party. So, you know, we're being forced to defend his position when we don't really agree with it. I think most people I think even senior military staff have been saying we don't really need to spend money on this. And I think ultimately, if we could transfer the Trident budget to other military uses and spend it more effectively, that's before we talk about spending it on hospitals and schools.
Okay, another big announcement on Monday, was to do with the pension change revolution, it's called. Major changes to UK pension rules come into force midnight on Monday. Chancellor George Osborne's called it a revolution. He said moves were the biggest changes to pensions in 100 years. People aged 55 and over will be given new powers to decide what to do with their retirement savings. Martin, is this, ask you first on this. Is this a good thing or a bad thing or what?
I think in the round it's a good thing, as long as you don't get large amounts of dodgy companies that are putting people under pressure over the phone to do something outrageous with their, you know, their pension scheme.
But the thing is, people have had tax breaks, haven't they, in order to build up these pension pots. Mm. Now we're saying, oh well, forget that. It's just another kind of tax dodge. So it means you can get your hands on the money much earlier than you were supposed to, and you haven't had to pay tax on the money that's gone into your pension pot.
I guess you're absolutely right, and I think it's probably a Tory ploy anyway to try and appeal to their blue rinse voters.
Is it as simple as a bribe?
I would say so. Yeah, probably.
Well, I think that sums it up. It is a bribe.
And also, it's another way to prop up the buy-to-let market. You know, this is the housing market, which is starting to falter a little. Mm. You know, more money going into that. So I saw very little, if any, analysis of this and the coverage of this.
Well, I think what you made the point, Tony, that the reason why people get tax relief on pensions is because they are pensions. You could argue that we shouldn't have tax relief on pensions at all. People just save in the bank and they draw it out when they draw it out. But you know, the pensions industry is protected by all of this kind of legislation, and now, of course, it's not even. We're going to find a situation where this will create a further splurge in the housing market, which will just make the follow-on crash more catastrophic than it would otherwise have been.
Mm. Okay, the NHS. 100 doctors have signed a letter accusing the Tories of broken promises over privatisation. This is last weekend. In a joint letter, experts claim David Cameron was fuelling privatisation of healthcare and warned the NHS was withering away. Back to the old health service again, Ben.
I agree. I think the Tories have let the NHS down really, really badly. But then I'll spread the love, because I don't think Labour did a great job with them either. You know, they've tied up lots of authorities with really nasty PFI deals. And I think to blame the Tories completely for the privatisation of the health services is a little bit unfair, because Labour have been doing it anyway. But you mentioned something also about Nigel Farage earlier, and I guess sometimes there is a case where there is a service, or I don't know, some procurement, something that could be done and could be done cheaper by private companies sort of doing it doing it for the NHS.
Martin?
Well, I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of the NHS, the principle of the NHS. You can't. It's either a planned system or it's not. Mm. I mean, I think it's very interesting to hear that your views on this. I mean, as you know, that Cameron promised not to have a top-down reorganisation, and he has.
Yeah,
I totally take your point about the Labour Party opening the door to this. The problem is that the lobbying industry of private healthcare in the US tries to dominate the political process, just like the bankers do.
Absolutely,
and that's exactly what's going on.
I think there's a few points there as well. I do not understand why the political class in this country want to model ourselves on America and take lots of their ideas, like they're, you know, there's some great nation that's got everything right.
Well, certainly not their healthcare. I'm afraid the Obamacare thing has been an absolute shambles.
That has been a
because
shambles.
Because what it's done is it's basically made it compulsory for people to take out private insurance, which they can't afford and doesn't actually cover them.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that's not a solution. The beauty of the British National Health System is that the outcomes are the best in the world for the inputs, and it's because it is a free system, and if any attempt to try and cost it through insurance is a less efficient way of doing it. It just is.
Okay, I want to finish this evening on a story to do with a chap that's been on our sister show Dialect and on here a couple of times. That's Julian Parry. He's from North Somerset. He's an inventor of all sorts of waste treatment. He's also an exposer of corruption in North Somerset with the way that they deal with their waste. I always remember chatting to a friend of mine, Charlie, over in Italy, and he said, if you ever want to find where the mafia are, I'll just follow the way that refuse and waste is dealt with. You'll find them pretty quickly. Anyway, so Julian's very seriously ill in hospital, but he did say some fascinating things to me at the end of last year about corruption in North Somerset, particularly the way that the council sold off Knightstone Island. £8 million, roughly, that should have been worth, but it was sold to Redrow Homes for £1 a year lease, for a 250-year lease. Unbelievable. Anyway, so here's Julian Parry now.
Local authorities seem to be sort of asset stripping stuff which has been built up by decades and maybe even a century old of generations, trying to make sure that people in the future, that the local authorities, that our common space is well looked after, that there's plenty of it, that there are lots of municipal buildings. This all seems now to be being asset stripped.
It's being asset stripped by individuals, not by the councils. It's individuals who hold high position in the councils and do things behind closed doors, and Knightstone Island is yet another example. Knightstone Island was sold effectively to Redrow Homes South West on the 24th of June 2005 in a lease, the terms of which were a lease for 250 years, you won't get it back after the end of that, at £1 a year. The value of the site, if it had gone to auction, would have been about £8 million. Now, when we reported this to the police, local police commander Alex Cohen told me to go to Action Fraud. I went to Action Fraud a year ago on the 8th of October. By the 10th of October, they had given it a crime number and it was being examined by national fraud experts. At about 11 o'clock on the morning of the 18th of October, the telephone rang and a voice said to me, "Action Fraud, sir." I said, "Good to hear from you. Your complaint of fraud." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Not fraud, sir." I said, "No, no, sir, not fraud. This is corruption, and we're dealing with it." "Absolutely splendid," I said. "I've got no problem with that. You call it what you will. I still think it's fraud, but up to you." And off he went. Of course, there has been no investigation. I have written to the chief constable twice to ask him what has happened about the investigation. He, unfortunately, Nick Gargan, has been suspended. Some think on fitted up charges. We shall see. But certainly he seemed to be getting things right, and then he was got out of the way. So we shall see what happens there.
Okay, so let's just summarise what happened with Knightstone Island. It was sold on a 250-year lease for £1 a year to Redrow Homes.
Yes.
Now, that is, you know, quite clearly millions of pounds worth of local authority, council property, our property, the people of Weston's property, that's been basically given away.
Absolutely. And the good people of Weston-super-Mare purchased it in 1896. So, the fact of the matter is that it was given away, and yet the councillors did not know what the price was, did not know what the deal was, and my friend, the sadly late Bob Coleman, who died in April, by the way, but he had an argument with the now late leader of the Liberal Democrats, Alan Hockridge, and they had a nose-to-nose in the council corridor outside the chamber, where Hockridge said to Coleman, "Leave us alone on what we're doing with Knightstone."
What do you do about white-collar crime, guys? You got 15 seconds each.
Root it out, get rid.
I'm really sorry to hear that about the Julian's illness, and he was a great fighter for the truth.
Come on, Avon and Somerset Police, prosecute people selling off public assets for next to nothing. Anyway, it's time to finish now with Ben Walker
this
from Bradley
Bristol's
Stoke. BCFM. UKIP councillor, sorry, the Conservatives couldn't be with us because online, they couldn't put somebody up today. Anyway, after the news, we'll be doing Miscarriages of Justice and Secret Courts, plus the Malcolm X Film Festival on Sunday.
National news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.